So we're in the beginning of the fifth chapter of Second Canto. It's the chapter's heading is the cause of all causes. So we know who the cause of all causes is, right? Ishvara Parama Krishna. Satchit Ananda Vigraha Anadir Adir Govinda Sabakarana Karanam. He's the Karana of all Karanas. And those that don't know that Krishna is the Karana of all Karanas, they take a look at one of the causal factors and think, aha! This is the truth. This is the source of all other truths. And in this chapter 2, excuse me, in chapter 5, the cause of all causes, Narada is playing the role, or he's induced by Krishna to mistake Lord Brahma as the cause of all causes. Prabhupada explains that like Arjuna was put in the position that he had forgotten that Krishna is the personality of Godhead. Although all the Pandavas, as well as Bhishma, as well as Kunti, they perfectly knew that Krishna is the super soul and the supreme personality of Godhead. Just so that Krishna could speak Bhagavad Gita to Arjuna, he induced Arjuna to that position of forgetfulness. So Narada is also induced to forgetting Krishna's position and thinking that Brahma is the cause of all causes. In fact, he glorifies him that way, and then he asks, but how is it possible? So this chapter is Shukadeva Goswami's answer to what was asked in the beginning of the previous chapter. How does the Lord work with his energies to bring about creation? So there's three factors here. There's the design of creation, there's the energies of creation, and there's the controller and source. And in this chapter, Prabhupada addresses some of the same arguments in principle that are being argued in the courtrooms of the United States, at least where the Board of Education is demanding that the high school science textbooks include some other model besides evolution as an explanation of how there's variety within creation, besides the origin of species argument of Charles Darwin, the intelligent design argument. They're arguing it in court. And they're using some of the similar logic that we find in Srila Prabhupada's Bhagavatam. Now logic, as we know, it doesn't prove anything. It's a type of pramana, but it's not conclusive. What's conclusive is shabda pramana, or descending knowledge, not argument and logic or sense perception. But Prabhupada gives some of the same logical arguments here in this chapter. So the first two verses that we've already read is Narada. The first one is Narada honoring Lord Brahma, offering his respectful obeisances, asking him then to give transcendental knowledge in relation to the soul and the super soul, and following that question, he asks specifically about creation. He asks about five questions. What are the symptoms of this manifest world? And when Brahma speaks one by one, he's going to give answers. So let's see if we can remember the sequence, because we'll refer back this text too as the code for the chapter. What are the symptoms of the material world? What is its background? Prabhupada, in the purport here, explores chance and design. I'll just read. The intelligent man can see that neither the living entity nor the phenomenal world are creations of chance. Now, this just happens to be the very same words that modern science is using. When to go to the page of modern science for a moment, and when studying some phenomena in nature, whether it's an artifact, say an archaeological artifact, let's be specific. When archaeologists find an arrowhead, they're doing some excavation and they find an arrowhead. So there's three possibilities that they consider. Is it chance? Is it the laws of nature? Or was it designed? And when you find something that's shaped with a point to it and sides that make it sharp along one side and the other side, and something that looks like it could hold the shaft of a spear or an arrow, it could be just nature shaped it that way. It could be. And it could be that a person shaped it that way with some instrument. So they can't say conclusively whether this was made by a man or it was created by nature, by natural forces. But then if they find 40 or 50 of them in a 50-foot radius, and they find a hammer and a chisel in that same 50-foot radius, they're all shaped the same way, and they all seem to have, you know, the same kind of strokes that make the arrowhead, then they conclude it's design, instead of nature made it that way. Then another example that they use is Mount Rushmore. When you look at Mount Rushmore, anybody here not know what Mount Rushmore is? In somewhere in North Dakota? South Dakota? Okay, excuse me. You distributed books there? It's a good spot? So-so? Okay. In South Dakota, there's some mountains in South Dakota, and there's one place in those mountains of South Dakota where there's, it looks like the faces of three of our presidents of the United States. Teddy Roosevelt and George Washington and Abraham Lincoln, those three. So, four of them? Okay, Thomas Jefferson. So, it just had to be like that way because it's the laws of nature. It just had to be that way. That's a possibility one might want to consider. Or it just happened that way. All other surfaces on mountainsides don't have those configurations. This one just happens to have it. Or the third possibility was designed. And now, because people know the history, there's a guy, a young man, that spent good part of his life climbing up that mountain with a hammer and chisel and chiseled out the shapes of these presidents and the mountainside, and now it's a, you know, big tourist trap, a place where people go and look at the images of these presidents carved into the side of a mountain. So there's an example of design. They've even gone into, there's a mathematician whose name I can't remember, who wrote a book on when you see design, what are the logical steps that must be performed before you conclude it's design. And I can't remember what they are, but it's inference, it's not proof, but there's logical steps that one takes to say that there's design. In this little video presentation, they show sculpted bushes that look like an elephant, another one looks like a bird, another one looks like a monkey, whatever, one looks like a cat. And is it by chance, is it by necessity, or is it by design? So the statement that Prabhupada is making here is the symmetry of creation and its regulative actions and reactions suggests the plan of an intelligent brain. Intelligent design argument. Quite a few years ago, chapter Canto 2, 1970. So there's a purpose to be fulfilled. So intelligent design or plan is the language that they're using these days. There's a purpose, a design, a plan. So purposefully creation has come out the way that it has, and the symmetry, this is forget his name, one Christian theologian came up with seven proofs of God, and none of them are proofs, they're just logical. What's the name?
Thomas Aquinas,
thank you. So one of those seven is this one. It's called teleology, and where there's order, even from mathematics, Sariputta goes down this path. I hope you don't mind, because this is just to give it a little liveliness to the facts and information here in the Bhagavatam. But there's a mathematical axiom that randomness, the word is entropy, increases over time. So if you start with something that has order to it, and time passes, it becomes more random. You draw a graph, and going in that way is time, and entropy increases. Just because things move around, atoms, and you know, things deteriorate. The time energy is working, and order becomes chaos. And the only way that it goes, randomness goes down, is when you apply intelligence. There's an outside force bringing about something that increases order to chaos. It's just a mathematical understanding. And so the idea that over time it all started in chaos, and as time passed it became more ordered, is a mathematical impossibility. If there's no other agent than time, and by chance order comes from chaos, so the primordial soup, and there's a big bang, and presto, you get order. You don't get order from big bangs. You have chaos. It's by inference. It's not a proof, but it's a proof of logic. And the other kind of proof is this descending knowledge. So anyway, Narada is asking Brahma for that descending knowledge method of what's in the background. Is it chance or is it by design? And are you not that designer? How did you do it? How did the creation take place? And Brahma's going to answer these things. How is it conserved? And under whose control is all this being done? So, in the final sentence of this purport, Prabhupada writes that by inference we can understand there's an intelligence behind it, and by inquiry we can know who that intelligence belongs to. Who is the person? By inquiring from the right source. My dear father, Narada speaking to Brahma, all this is known to you scientifically because whatever was created in the past and whatever will be created in the future and whatever is being created at present, as well as everything within the universe, is within your grip just like a walnut. So he uses two metaphors. This is one of them. In your grip like a walnut, like, you know, there's this phrase that I couldn't figure out for quite some time that's used in India all the time. It's in your hand. Right? Like you got control of the situation. Or the money's in, whatever it is. It's in your hand. He's got the situation in the English phrase, American phrase, is you got the situation in hand. So here it's He, like within one's hand, one's holding a walnut. So, Brahma, you have this vast intelligence that's so vast. The answers to these questions are in your grip. Whatever was created, the knowledge and also the objects that are the fruit of that knowledge, things created in the past, things that are being created, and things that will be created, you got, it's under your control. Then he asks a good question. My dear father, what is the source of your knowledge? Under whose protection are you standing? And under whom are you working? What is your real position? Do you alone create all entities with material elements by your personal energy? Because that's the position of the personality of Godhead. Svarat. He's self-sufficient. The Supreme Personality, or the Absolute Truth, is that from which everything else comes, and he doesn't depend on anything else. There's no truth. Matak parataram namyat kinchid asti dhananjaya. There's no truth superior to Krishna. Everything comes from Krishna, and there's not something above Krishna from whom he derives. Like this rhetorical question that says, if God creates everything, who creates God? But by definition, God is that from which everything else is created, and so it's just a rhetorical question. There's nothing from which God comes, or nobody that creates God. He's the, by definition, the cause of all causes, sarva karana karanam. So we're dealing now with, again, these two things. Intelligence, where does your intelligence come from, and where does the energy come from? Because to have creation, you have to have those two things. You have to have some other thing. You have to have time as well. But intelligence, where's the intelligence for your part of creation come from, and where does the energy for your part of creation come from? Is it coming from yourself? Then he gives a second example, the example of a spider. And the example of the spider is, it's used several times in the Bhagavatam. Prabhupada says in the purport, the sun is a better example. But the spider, from his own body, he creates a web. From his saliva, he spins a web, and then he moves around in the web, and if he wants to, he can withdraw the web back into his body. So, like the spider, he doesn't ask it as a question, he makes it as a statement. You create from your own energies. But then, Prabhupada very aptly explains that the sun is a better example, because the sun generates its own energy, whereas the spider is dependent upon something it takes from outside of itself to create the ingredients that then become its web. But then it gets a little more subtle than that, because where does the sun come from? And then where the sun comes from, where does that come from? Because when you start speaking of cause, the cause of causes, and the cause of all causes, you have to ask those questions. So, the Supreme Lord, energetically, is like the sun, in that the sun generates energy, and the Lord Brahma is like the spider, where the spider generates its web, but it's deriving the capacity to generate the web and the ingredients for the web, and whatever intelligence it takes to make webs, from some other source. Then he goes on, whatever we can understand by the nomenclature, characteristics, and features of a particular thing, superior or inferior, eternal or temporary, is not created from any source other than of your Lordship, Thou So Great. Which is not true. It's not true in two ways. One is, he's saying that there are things that are eternal, comes from no other source but you, and that's not so. Because things that are eternal. And things that are eternal, even they're co-eternal with Krishna. Krishna is the source, not Brahma, who is also created. Or one of Krishna's energies. And even those things that Brahma does create, he's dependent upon Krishna to create. But he's thinking, he is this independent source. So he's asking questions and he's making statements. Asking the questions is fine. He's making statements that are partially correct and partially wrong. So, text 7. There's just two more of Narada's statements here. Now he's asking, I have a doubt. And the doubt is, I see that you're undergoing some type of austerities, and I see that you're meditating. And if you're meditating, then who is it that you're meditating on? Is it that you're meditating on yourself? And you yourself are supreme? Because Krishna also sets that example. You know that? In Dwarka? It's described in the Bhagavatam. When the rooster makes his rooster sound in the morning, crowing, is that what it does?
Cock-a-doodle-doo
sound. When the rooster does the rooster call, Krishna rises from his bed and takes his morning bath and does his morning sadhana. But because he's Krishna, he meditates upon himself. And this process, ahangra upasana, is mentioned in the purport here. And it's a bona fide, and Krishna did it to verify it's bona fide. Of course, in Krishna's case it works, because he's meditating on the Supreme Personality of Godhead when he meditates upon himself. But as a process of self-realization for those who would very strongly wish that they were God, they also take up this meditation upon oneself in order to become self-realized. And these people are impersonalists. But it's also mentioned in Bhagavad Gita, chapter 9, text 15, where in this section of chapter 9, Krishna is speaking of those who worship me. And he describes in text 14, who knows what 9:14 is, Bhagavad Gita? Any Bhagavad Gita buffs here? Satatam kirtayanto mam yatantas chadridhavrata namasyantas chamam nityam tushanti cha. Excuse me. Namasyantas chamam bhakcha nitya yukta upasate. So he's speaking of the great souls, the mahatmas. And they're engaged in this particular way, always engaged in chanting my glories, always endeavoring with great determination. Namasyantas cha mam nityam, always bowing before me. These great souls perpetually worship me with devotion. Nitya yukta upasate. Then in the next, he describes others that in a very liberal mood, Krishna considers also to be worshippers of him. And there's three categories that he indicates: ekatvena, pratakvena, bahuda, vishvato mukham. So they worship the universal form, and that way they worship Krishna. Or pratakvena, they worship the many, the worshippers of the many devas, understanding that they represent the personality of Godhead. Or ekatvena, they worship themselves. And here's what Prabhupada writes in the purport. Besides the Mahatma, there is the indication given earlier in Bhagavad Gita that there are four types of persons that render service to Krishna out of some motivation. Then that's below the Mahatmas. And below those group of people is another group of people that Krishna is very liberally considering also to be his worshippers or his devotees. There are those who are still lower, and these are divided into three. One, he who worships himself as one with the Supreme Lord, ekatvena. Two, he who concocts some form of the Lord and worships that, pratakvena, bahuda. And three, he who accepts the universal form, the Vishwarupa of the Supreme Lord, and worships that, vishvato mukham. So then Prabhupada explains, out of the three, the lowest, those who worship themselves as the Supreme Lord, thinking themselves to be modists, are most prominent. Such people think themselves to be the Supreme Lord, and in this mentality, they worship themselves. I heard a description once that someone was doing this, somebody or other in India on stage, and they got out an RT thing and they got out a big mirror and were worshiping themselves on stage, showing their followers how they should worship him because he's God. Something like that. So Prabhupada speaks about that in the purport here. The ahangra upasita, or the one who worships himself with the idea of becoming God himself, is misleading. So the direction Prabhupada is going with this is that the disciple, Narada, should, he's showing by his example to not make the mistake that the guru should be considered God, but the guru should be considered confidential representative of God and therefore respected like God, but not to think that he's God. Since we all just took prasadam, I'll tell a little story to keep everybody from falling asleep wide awake. Prabhupada, going back to 1970, summer of 1970. From when Prabhupada began speaking Krishna consciousness to his Western audience, he was very strong about one who says that he is God, he is dog. Just reverse. G-O-D-D-O-G. And no, he was not very gentle with impersonalists because he wanted to protect his young disciples from impersonal teaching. So he was very strong. And in the summer of 1970, Nectar Devotion was published. Prabhupada's summary study of Rupa Goswami's Bhakti Rasamrita Sindhu. And what had been a practice for the previous 2 years, 1968 and 1969, is on Janmashtami day, whatever devotees could would go to Vrindavan to celebrate Janmashtami together, because we didn't have deities in many temples, many places, and it was a nice time to come together and have a big festival. So that summer of 1970, Nectar Devotion had just come out, and Prabhupada had just given sannyas just before Janmashtami, during the summer, to four devotees. Those four devotees were big devotees: Brahmananda, Vishnu John, Gargamuni, Brahmananda's brother, and Subhal. Those four were given sannyas. And so they were up there as far as, you know, our society was concerned, although they were just young men. And when they went to New Vrindavan, they had advanced copies of Nectar Devotion because it wasn't available for general distribution yet. They had advanced copies because they were sannyasis. And then they started. The day after Janmashtami is Prabhupada's Vyasa Puja. They were reading from Nectar Devotion on the qualifications of a spiritual master, and they're reading excerpts from Nectar Devotion in which they were concluding, the four of them, four barrels, were saying that Prabhupada is God. And it says so right here in Nectar Devotion. That's not what it says in Nectar Devotion. But that's what they were saying it says in Nectar Devotion. And message got to Srila Prabhupada really fast. And Prabhupada got back really fast and said, they're kicked out of this organization. They're banned from my temples. And if they want to rectify themselves, they can go somewhere separately and start practicing Krishna consciousness and try to preach Krishna consciousness and purify themselves. Prabhupada was heavy. Wow. Because he didn't like the idea of saying that he was God. And here in this purport, Prabhupada writes, following in the footsteps of Sri Narada Muni, one should not blindly accept his spiritual master as God himself. And if someone posing as a spiritual master claims to be God himself, well, that shouldn't be accepted. Although there are persons with this ahangra upasana, which is a process that's meant to realize one's spiritual nature, but not that the misappropriation of that process is thinking that I'm God, not making a distinction between Brahman and Parabrahman, or Atma and Paramatma, or Jiva and Krishna, the master and the servant. So here Narada is asking that question. His question is, yet we are moved to wonder about the existence of someone more powerful than you when we think of your great austerities in perfect discipline, although your good self is so powerful in the matter of creation. My dear Father, you know everything, and you are the controller of all. Therefore, may all I have inquired from you be kindly instructed to me so that I may be able to understand as your student. So Narada was thinking, everything has come from you. Why are you meditating on someone? Why are you undergoing austerities? For what? And does that mean that there's somebody greater than you? Kind of a naive question. And Prabhupada comments, it was like Arjuna being put into the position where he was asking Krishna, and Krishna could instruct him, and he could understand because he had the capacity to understand. So Narada is asking the same questions that Maharaj Parikshit has asked Shukadeva Goswami. Here's Brahma's answer. Or answers. We'll just cover a few of them. Lord Brahma said, my dear boy, Narada, being merciful to all, including me, you have asked all these questions because I have been inspired to see into the prowess of the Almighty Personality of Godhead. That's nice. Brahma has had an inquisitive spirit, and specifically inquisitive spirit into the Shaktis, the powers of Shaktiman, the possessor of those powers. Because Brahma had to do some service for the original creator. And so being the secondary creator, we can think of Brahma as the secondary creator. That's Prabhupada's language. The primary creation is Svarga, and Sarga. And this Sarga is the secondary creation. He goes on, whatever you have spoken about me is not false, because unless and until one is aware of the personality of Godhead, who is the ultimate truth beyond me, one is sure to be illusioned by observing my powerful activities. So he is now beginning to answer his questions. Back to text number two. under whose control is all this being done? That was his last question. That's getting the first one that's getting answered. The personality Godhead is the one under whom all things are being done, under whose direction all things are being done. Because the Supreme Lord instructed Brahma to undergo tapa. When he underwent tapa, then the Supreme Lord instructed him about the nature of reality, and he answered the four questions that Brahma asked in the Chatur-Sloki verses, which are coming up. And he then guided him throughout as the Super Soul and the master of Lord Brahma how to do the act of creation. So having inquired into the prowess of the personality of Godhead, now you're asking me that which I have realized, and it's perfectly appropriate. And then he explains this chronology, which is really nice. I create after the Lord's creation by his personal effulgence, known as Brahma Jyoti, just as when the sun manifests its fire, the moon, the firmament, the influential planets, and the twinkling stars all manifest their brightness. So there's this interesting interjection of the Brahma Jyoti suddenly comes into the picture. And Prabhupada very carefully explains it in the purport. Something that it's a little difficult to understand. This Sarvam Kalvidam Brahma, Prabhupada quotes that in Bhagavad Gita in his purports a few times. It's a Vedic utterance. Sarvam Kalv Idam Brahma. Everything comes from Brahman. Specifically, Prabhupada explains it in this purport. This means the Brahma Jyoti. But how does the undifferentiated Brahma Jyoti bring about the differentiated creation? And the answer is, there's the personality of Godhead in the background. And in the purport, Prabhupada explains this word pratishta from Bhagavad Gita 14:27, brahmanohi pratishtaham. Have I lost anybody yet? Brahmanohi pratishta. Prabhupada goes, says in the Nirukti dictionary, this word pratishta means that which establishes. So Krishna establishes Brahma Jyoti. Brahmano hi pratishta aham. Krishna is the source. The Brahma Jyoti rests upon Krishna, just as the sun light rests upon the sun, or exists because of the existence of the sun. As the rays of the sun have their existence because of the sun, the Brahma Jyoti has its existence because of the existence of Krishna. Krishna is the basis or support or that which establishes the Brahma Jyoti. And then the Brahma Jyoti, here's how Prabhupada writes it. It's the Lord disseminates all varieties of seeds by his potential Brahma Jyoti. He gives the example, in a banyan seed, there's a potential banyan tree, which is pretty hard to think of because the seed is so small and a banyan tree is so huge. But the potential is there within the seed. So where does the seed come from? It comes from a banyan tree. And where does the banyan tree come? It comes from a seed. Where does the seed come from? It comes from a banyan tree. So where does the seeds originally come from? And the trees, both at once, where do they come from? He's saying that as the banyan tree comes from the seed, so the seed of all existences comes from the Brahma Jyoti. I'll read it. Just as a small seed of a banyan fruit has the potency to create a big banyan tree, so similarly, the Lord disseminates all varieties of seeds by his potential Brahmajyoti, Sva Rochi Cha. And the seeds are made to develop by the watering process of persons like Brahma. He likens to Brahma to a gardener. The gardener can't generate the seeds other than, you know, you grow from plants, you get some fruits, and from the fruits you get some seeds, and then you can grow some more plants. But the gardener can't produce seeds from himself. Brahma, similarly, can't produce the cosmic manifestation from his own energy. He takes that which the Lord manifests through the Brahmajyoti, and he takes those things and he puts the creation together. The seed for generation comes from the Brahmajyoti, and the Brahmajyoti comes from the personality of Godhead. That's what we're hearing from Brahma explaining to Narada. Narada, it looks to you like, you know, I've done everything, but you should know that I get the seeds for doing what I'm doing from the Supreme Lord through the agency of his Brahmajyoti. That's what we're hearing. The example cited here by the sun is very appropriate. In the material world, the sun is the cause of all illumination. There are varieties of illumination. The sun is the cause of them all. Electricity, fire, rays of the moon, etc. Wherever there's light, it's either the sun or the transformation of the light of the sun. But fire generates light, but where does fire come from? Fire comes from the energy of the sun that's stored by the photosynthetic process in wood, and then you ignite the wood and you get fire. It's just the stored energy of the sun. Or it decays and it becomes petroleum and you light it and it becomes fire. Or it's eaten by cows and it becomes out as cow dung and you light it and it becomes fire. It's just the light of the sun and electricity. Electricity, the different ways to generate electricity. You know, the light of the sun shines on the ocean, and the ocean water evaporates and comes down in the form of rain, and they get a hydroelectric dam and you get out the energy and then you have electricity. It's just energy of the sun. Light is the energy of the sun, or the energy of the sun transforms. So as the sun is the source of all light in this dark universe, so and all luminaries in the sky likewise, so similarly, the Brahmajyoti is the source of the light of the sun, and Krishna is the source of the Brahmajyoti. The title of the chapter is The Cause of All Causes. Narada is inquiring, what's the cause? Where's the intelligence? Where do the ingredients come from? Is it not you? Yet, are you self-intelligent, or are you deriving your intelligence from some other place? Are you self-energetic, or are you deriving those energies from some other place? And he's deriving from some other place, and he's giving the answer. Where those energies come from? It comes from the seeds, which come from the Brahmajyoti, which comes from Krishna. And likewise, the intelligence. Then, so then that's answering one of the questions from text 2. What's the background of creation? He's giving layers of background. And he's giving a hint of an idea, not yet the detail of how is it created. He's just giving the causal sequences of how it is created. And then he also asks, what are the symptoms of this manifested world? So here we're going to get us, the next two verses is the symptoms. The symptoms is it's bewildering. One of the symptoms of this material world. I offer my obeisances and meditate upon Lord Krishna, Vasudeva, the personality of Godhead, whose invincible potency influences the less intelligent class of men to call me the supreme controller. The illusory energy of the Lord cannot take precedence, being ashamed of her position, but those who are bewildered by her always talk nonsense, being absorbed in thoughts of it is I and it is mine. This is as far as we're going to go. Just describe this a little bit. This is the symptom of the material world. It's bewildering influence upon those that are not fixed in the spiritual conception of life. And that's a lot of people. Even people that like to think of themselves in this conventional word today, spiritual. Spiritual, he or she is a spiritual person. Often it means, they're leaning towards the mode of goodness. They're spiritual. There's some kindness in their heart. They show compassion to others, or something like that. But the symptom of bewilderment, the symptom of this material world that bewilders the minds of most living entities, is thinking in terms of it is I and it is mine. It is I is the egoistic conception, and it is mine is the sense of ownership, false proprietorship. It's the doership mentality that Brahma has escaped because he got this special protection from Krishna to escape it. That while he's doing the act of creating, he would not consider himself to be the creator, but the instrument of the Lord's creation. And it's real easy when you're doing something and it comes out nicely to try to take credit for it. At least a little bit. And one may say all the right things. Oh, it's just Krishna's mercy, but really in one's heart, I want credit for it. At least I want people to recognize that I made a big effort. Humble effort, but... So, the purport demonstrates, or Prabhupada discusses, that in response to Narada's question, what's the symptom of this manifest world? The symptom of the manifest world is it bewilders a whole lot of people. And the symptom of that bewilderment is false ego. It is I. It is mine. That the mine conception follows the I conception. The absence of a spiritual conception of self is followed by pride. I did it, and therefore it is mine. And I'm proud of what is mine. The product of me is mine. So, as it's true for Brahma, whose service it is to create universes, or as it is for Shukadeva Goswami, whose service it is to speak Bhagavatam, or Vyasadeva, whose service it is to compile the Vedas, or our service, whatever it may be to make garlands or cook the feast or host the program or write the newsletter or whatever the thing is. We all have some service to do. The tendency to do that, even in devotional service to Krishna, through false ego is very strong. It's the symptom of the material world that we're trying to get out of. And so the reason, we'll go back to chapter 4, the reason that Maharaj Pariksit is asking this question is he wants to get out of his material world. He wants to act within the 7 days that he has left in the most effective way to achieve spiritual perfection. Although he's practically a perfected soul just by his nature already. He doesn't have a whole lot to go. But by hearing in the proper way, or by doing our service in the proper way, we can realize our relationship with Krishna. We were discussing this morning. By the process of devotional service itself, Shukadeva Goswami discloses, one can contact Krishna directly. One can commune with Krishna. One can see Krishna constantly. The process of devotional service is so potent if it's done in the right way. So we have to engage in devotional service, and we have to see that we're doing it in the right way or in the proper consciousness. And the way to get out of the improper consciousness is this way that Narada is doing. He's asking appropriate questions of Lord Brahma. And Brahma recognizes the qualification of Narada and the good questions he's asking, and he's giving proper answers. The symptom of this material world, what's it like? It's bewildering. The eye and mind conception is really strong. Really strong. And one should, by the process of hearing and empowered praying for Krishna for that right empowerment and receiving the mercy of those Shukadeva-like persons speaking it, to get lifted out of that condition by properly executed devotional service. And just concluding, because it's the theme of this canto 2 that we're reading about, that the approaching of the lotus feet of the Supreme Lord does require that we have a reasonable understanding of this place that we're residing in called the material world. While we're trying to be spiritual persons or Krishna conscious devotees, there's all this energy all around us. And how do we address ourselves to this energy that's happening? Sometimes, you know, pretty intensely. How do we regard this and not get bewildered by it? How do we see it in the proper way? This humble mood of service way is the way. Opportunities for service come our way. Sometimes we don't ask for them, they just come. Sometimes we ask for them and they come. Sometimes we ask for them, they don't come. But opportunities for service are provided. And we should take up those services in the proper mood, fortified by the hearing and chanting process, and then fixing our hearts in that right attitude to serve Krishna, depending upon praying to him, depending upon him for the empowerment to do that service in Krishna consciousness. Okay, so any discussion on this section of verses? Yes?
Okay. Maharaj, on the topic of unfinished devotional service, I understand that, you know, every time I have too much pride and I may not feel that it's Krishna's mercy, and I'm feeling very proud when someone's telling me something And you said that you should pray for the ability to do devotional service in an unpretentious manner, but at that time, if somebody's appreciating a service, and I'm feeling pride, am I being pretentious by saying, it's Krishna's mercy, and if yes, then how should I handle it?
Well, you can't pretend purity. You can practice it, though. So as you're, I mean, the indication that you're, that I'm taking out of what you just said is, I may say the words, but I know that inside my heart, I'm liking it very much. And proof of that is, if it didn't come, or if it was the opposite, I think I would start burning a little bit. So I'm lacking purity. That's just an honest statement that we can make to ourselves. But I want to practice it. So it's not just saying the words. I mean, saying the words helps to a certain degree deflect that energy to where it should go. But that's not enough. That's nice, but it's not enough. It's, you know, trying to fix our consciousness in the position of just being the instrument. And as purity awakens, we realize that's what's happening. More we can realize that that's what's happening. There's something that I can do. The one something that I can do is I can try to act in my relation, in my relationship with Krishna. I can exercise my free will, at least try to exercise my free will properly. That is to try to act in a way that's favorable to Krishna. That I can endeavor to do like that. And the rest, it's all up to Krishna. So that's, if there's anything that's mine, like this misconception of I and mine, doesn't, for the devotee, it's not, I'm nothing. And I have nothing. Now I'm spiritual. But there is something that we do have, and that's our relationship with Krishna. Or as in the Sharanagati songs of Bhaktivinoda Thakur, he explores Atmanivedana, full dedication of body, mind, and words unto the service of Krishna. And preceding that is humility. I am so insignificant, and I therefore have nothing. But there is something that I do have. In submission, Krishna, I am yours. And you are mine. Or not that you own Krishna and put him in your pocket and go down the street with him, but the relationship with Krishna is yours. That's one thing. Then when everything else is taken away, because it's all going to be taken away, there's one thing that remains. Your relationship with Krishna. And the spirit soul, that's eternal, and the relationship with Krishna is eternal. So let my endeavor be to stay in that consciousness. Come to that consciousness and stay in that consciousness. That's purity. Let me strive for that. So now the question that you asked is that pretentious? So then it depends. So there's, if you're striving for that, back to the answer I was giving this morning, or in our discussion about Rupa Goswami's teaching, which I like very much, is that even in the practicing stage, in the sadhana bhakti stage, if one is cultivating that consciousness, that's unpretentious. That's uttam bhakti. But we have to stay under the protection of Rupa Goswami's teachings. Because it's the protection of Rupa Goswami's teachings that will carry us. It's the protection of descending mercy that will carry us to that position. Not our endeavor, not our sincerity, not anything from our side. There's something we have to do from our side. It's not that alone. We're very fortunate to be under the protection of Rupa Goswami's teachings. That means Lord Chaitanya's teachings. So we have to want that and cultivate that, even though we're not there. So the lack of pretense is that you're recognizing I'm not there. And the shelter or the protection from I'm not there is Rupa Goswami's uplifting mercy and our Acharya's uplifting mercy. They're repeatedly instructing us. And we know we faithfully keep going to the classes where the instruction keeps coming. And slowly it's sinking in. Slowly it's wearing away our, you know, our resistance. Anything else? Yeah.
I'm not sure if this is related to what is needed some elaboration on the two spiritual paths, the Pravritti Mark and the Nivritti Mark, and why is the Nivritti Mark better than Pravritti Mark?
The path of Bhagavat Dharma, the path of the Srimad Bhagavatam, is that progressively one's involvement with Krishna, one's absorption in Krishna should increase. And as one's absorption in Krishna increases, one's material involvement and absorption decreases. And that's what... So nivritti is I voluntarily accept that and may I cultivate that decreasing material involvement so that I have more opportunity or more freedom of consciousness for absorption in Krishna. Or another way of saying the same thing is, in advance, I'm choosing to not come to Krishna in a mercantile mentality. Although I may have desires apart from Krishna, I don't want to do business with Krishna. I want to cultivate like that. Because Pravritti is a business. I'll do this and you supply that. And I don't want to do business with Krishna. I want a different relationship with Krishna than a business relationship with Krishna. I want a loving relationship with Krishna. So I want to cultivate. So that's nivritti. You see what the goal is and you cultivate getting to the goal. Or you understand what the process is and so you're cultivating appropriately the process. Or another way to answer your question is how Prabhupada puts it in Bhagavad Gita. If you're trying to start a fire, it is not helpful to start a fire to pour water in the fire as you're trying to start the fire. And pravritti is like putting water on a fire when trying to start it. Increasing sense gratification while trying to awaken Krishna consciousness. Anything else? Yes?
Well, actually, it's Maharaj's question, and also was on the. It is very much the topic of Brahma, like saying, it's not me, it's Krishna. Uh-huh. So. I wonder, like, is this correct? I kind of came to the conclusion that trying to say that it's Krishna's mercy just didn't... It just didn't cut it for me, yeah. And it kind of actually almost spoils or took what little meditation I did have, maybe, because I know that sounds right, and I seem to make it all external for me. So, and then I did reckon I did need the appreciation. I kind of did actually need it. But then when I accepted the appreciation, then I felt silly. Here I am, this is Krishna thing, and but yet here I am looking for appreciation and needing it, but that's silly, because it's not needed. So I found myself accepting it, saying thank you, kind of like whatever, and seem to be taking the praise or taking the appreciation. But is that kind of questionable honesty, or is it more cases, no, it's Krishna's mercy, God keeps saying it's Krishna's mercy, but practice.
Yeah, you practice, but try to enter into the spirit of the practice. You don't stop putting on tilak because I'm not really fully in the consciousness of what putting tilak on means. We do vaidhi sadhana bhakti with the purpose behind it in mind. Otherwise one doesn't get the full benefit of vaidhi sadhana bhakti just by the ritual. The ritual of Krishna's mercy. Or something. I mean, I appreciate the honesty that you're expressing, that just, you know, the politically correct statement is uncomfortable. And it's just so easy to do it mechanically and have it so hollow that it's just disgusting. And others may not be disgusted, but when I speak it, I'm disgusted. So, but then what do you do is you don't abandon the sadhana, you enter into the spirit of the vidhi. What does it mean? Krishna's mercy. And people write these letters that I don't even know, and they say, by your mercy, something happened. And it's just, you know, it's hollow. So we enter into the spirit. We don't abandon the form. We go for the substance. And think of, if you like, think of a different way, a different expression that is personal to you, and then use that expression. So it's not hollow. But whatever the expression is, you have to do something. It's impersonal to just, you know, deflect it. And it's materialistic to absorb it. And it's hollow to just, you know, say some empty words. You gotta do something. So, consider inside, you know, what is it you want to happen? You want to be transparent. You don't want it to go to you, you want it to go through you, to where the credit is deserved. So you can say something, think of something that's creative, rather than just mechanical. Or, you know, a nice Vaishnava thing to do is to honor another Vaishnava, or to honor the person who is, oh, you only see like this because your eyes are, you know, you're so much filled with devotion, you see Krishna everywhere. Or some, you know, something. But, you know, not just something out of the Chaitanya Charitamrita. Something from your heart. Something from your heart. That's what you want to get, is something that's coming from your heart. And this happens, and it's one of the It's the fourth category of anartha. You know, when there's a little bit of success in spiritual life, how are you going to process that? And that happens amongst Vaishnavas. Sanatana Goswami was honored in such a way by Haridas Thakur. He didn't go into all this denial stuff. He just glorified Haridas Thakur. He used that which Haridas Thakur was appreciating for, that is, being a recipient of Lord Chaitanya's mercy, and he used that mercy to glorify Haridas Thakur. And Haridas Thakur didn't go wimping in a corner saying, you know, oh, you can't do that because... Just Vaishnava exchange, where it doesn't go in and doesn't bounce. It's just, it's the glorification goes to the Lord and his devotees. So one has to learn that art. It's one of the challenges of devotional service. Will you take sannyas? It's a real trip. As a brahmachari, you know, your mood is you're the servant of everyone. You're the servant. That's how Prabhupada trained us. We're the brahmacharis, the servant of, humble servant of everyone. And a real good brahmachari becomes a sannyasi, and then everybody bows at his feet. It's my blower. So you want to bow to everybody. And then they say, no, 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 you can't do that, Maharaj. I mean, I can't do that. Can't be humble. That's the prohibition. You become a sannyasi. You're prohibited. I'm going to pay obeisances. But then at a certain point, at least in my personal experience, the understanding gradually came that it's actually spiritually beneficial for persons to do that. It's not to you. It's spiritually, it's a service that you're doing. And it's spiritually beneficial. The responsibility is to be exemplary. So when they're paying obeisances and doing the ritual, it's not, you know, to a monkey. I have to, so I take it that this is an instruction to me that I have to be exemplary. It's very sobering. And don't let it become, you know, complacent and business as usual. But it's part of the Vedic culture for elevation to offer respect to a sannyasi. You make any advancement in spiritual life and something, you do something nice for Krishna. Something's going to come your way. So don't do something nice for Krishna, because something might come your way and you don't know how to handle it, other than, you know, becoming impersonal or mechanical or, you know, absorbing it. Don't do any of those. Continue doing things nice for Krishna and learn the art of just everything goes to Krishna. It's part of the challenge of doing something nice. All credit goes to Krishna. Therefore, the short praise is Krishna's mercy. You know, the mindless message. So we have to be internally thoughtful and act and speak from your heart. Anything else? Yeah?
So from the discussion, it seems that unless one is completely secure in one's relationship with Guru and Krishna, the residual tendencies of seeking...
All kinds of stuff. All kinds of stuff.
...will be there. And till then, so the real solution is to enhance that relationship.
Put first things first.
Until then, be honest. And act in the way you're describing, in a sort of a regulative way,
Well, the regulative way can be there afterwards too. It's just, you know, go to the heart of the matter. Something else? Okay. We'll break. Grantharachi Mad Bhagavatam Ki.